So I'm really excited because this is the first sermon I've ever given. And so I've been, as you imagine, I've been rehearsing and I've been practicing this because it's kind of a big deal. And so I decided that it would be a good idea to practice with my children last night, and it put them straight to sleep. So hopefully it will have the desired effect for you today. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be talking about the story of Esther. There's only one slide. Would you mind clicking it forward for me? Okay. So, and we're going to be talking about how we find in the story of Esther something about what God has for us in our lives and what, in some respects, our daily life as Christians ought to look like. And so we're going to recap the story of Esther together. I really recommend you read it, actually, because I'm sure you have already, but I really recommend that you reread it. It'll only take you about 20 minutes or something like that to read through. And it's an amazing story. It's really fast-paced. It's got everything in it. It's got issues about sort of Shakespearean power. It's got a really good baddie. It's got a discussion of feminism that it then contrasts with post-feminism. It's amazing. Anyway, it's got a bit of violence and stuff like that in it, too. So it's really entertaining. Anyway, so and then once we've had a chat with the story of Esther, then we're going to think about where we are in our own story. And as I recap the story with you, what I'd really love for you to do is to think about yourself and your own life and wonder where you most identify with Esther's trajectory here. Because I think that all of us at some point can relate to the story of Esther somewhere. And there's this wonderful challenge that we're going to come across that you might know already, the challenge of Mordecai, who's Esther's uncle. We're going to meet him in a minute. And then finally, we're going to talk about how Jesus has changed everything and about how Jesus comes to bear on this story and actually helps us to understand how we relate to Esther in a completely new light. One of the fascinating things about the book of Esther, I'm sure many of you already know, is the fact that actually God isn't mentioned once throughout the entire book, but God's fingerprints are all over it. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. So if we start with the story of Esther, so it all kicks off with this king, a guy called Xerxes. I like to think of him as Xerxes the peanut brain, because actually he's an enormously powerful king, and in that time-honored Shakespearean tradition, he's also immensely stupid and easily led. And I'll point out a couple of episodes where I think that he's been a bit like that. Anyway, Xerxes hosts this enormous festival to celebrate his power and the success and the wealth of his kingdom. He has all his nobles, and this festival lasts for 180 days. Can you imagine taking all of your leaders out of their office for 6 months of the year? Xerxes the peanut brain. Anyway, so then at the end of this huge festival, he has a 7-day long feast. And in the seventh day of that feast, he decides as a special treat for all his male nobles that he's going to invite his queen, Vashti, who was famous for her good looks, to come along and present herself before them as sort of a final special treat. But interestingly, Vashti then refuses to come and present herself. And that presents Xerxes with quite a serious problem. You see, he's advised by his rulers and his nobles at the time, what you really need to do now is make an example of Vashti. Because if you allow her to disobey you now, then all the women in all the land will start to disobey all the men. I mean, just imagine that. Anyway, so they decide to make a great example of Vashti, and she's banished from the palace, never to be seen in the king's sight again. But that gives Xerxes a new problem. See, now he's a great, powerful ruler, but he doesn't have a beautiful wife anymore. So he has to find one. So what he does is he essentially invents the first ever Pan-Persian Love Island competition, of which he's the only male participant. And so what happens is all the most beautiful young women from around the country are invited to be put forward to enter this competition to see which is the most beautiful in the land and therefore who can become the next queen. And that's how Esther enters our story. And actually Esther's called Hadassah at first. Esther's not really her name. Esther's a nickname that gets given to her. Hadassah's her given name. And she grows up as an orphan Jewish girl in an intensely patriarchal and anti-Semitic society. She's not someone who you would have pointed at and said, you know what, she's going to change the fate of this nation. History books will be written about her. No one would have thought that. Esther or Hadassah as a young girl looked like pretty much a no-hoper. Mordecai, her uncle, raised her because her parents weren't around. She was an orphan. Mordecai seems to have raised her really well. He was a good uncle. I think he was probably a noble because of various bits in the book, but I'm not entirely clear about that. But anyway, so he's hanging around the city centre and the palace gate quite a lot of the time. And she's brought up, and it turns out that he knows about this competition. So he enters Hadassah. Hadassah, as she grew into a young woman, became known as Esther because she grew into a particularly beautiful young woman. Esther is roughly translated from the phrase as a star Esther. So she's actually given this nickname because of her good looks. So she enters the competition, and quite frankly, she just runs away with it. There are others that go before her, but when it comes to her turn, the king doesn't invite a single other woman to meet him. He's just so enthralled with Esther, he actually sends everybody else home, ends the competition, and she becomes the new queen. Shortly after she's the queen, Mordecai's hanging out at the king's gate, as he often seems to be doing, and he overhears guards talking about how they're angry with King Xerxes, and they want to assassinate him. Mordecai passes the plot on to Esther, who alerts the authorities, lets Mordecai know. The would-be assassins are then captured and executed. But weirdly enough, Mordecai, even though the credit is clearly given to him, isn't celebrated, isn't honoured, doesn't really receive anything for his efforts. And so the story moves on a little bit, and in comes the baddie, Haman. And he's a proper baddie. He's sort of one of those Shakespearean type characters again. He comes in, he's rich, he's powerful, he has lots of land and property, and he's cunning. He also has an agenda. He hates the Jewish people. And he's elevated above the other nobles. And all the other nobles are supposed to bow to him as he goes past them. But one refuses. Guess who? It's Mordecai. So he won't bow to Haman. Haman is incensed by this. So he creates this plan not just to punish Mordecai, but to punish the entire Jewish people. And so he offers Xerxes' treasury an overwhelming amount of wealth in order to ask Xerxes to pass an edict such that in one day, in a couple of months' time, all the Jewish people in all the 127 provinces of the area will be under threat from their neighbours. Because it says that if you live anywhere near the Jewish people, you can rise up and kill, annihilate, and destroy the Jews and take their property for yourselves on this date in the future. So the Jews are essentially left with a choice, aren't they? They either flee the nation entirely or they stay there, possibly to be killed by their neighbours for their stuff. And so, as you could imagine, the Jewish people go into mourning. Mordecai is found with sackcloth and ashes. He covers his face in ashes to show how distraught he is by this. And Esther seems a bit oblivious of this at first until she realizes that this is what's happening with Mordecai. She sends messages to him, asks him what's going on, and he explains the situation. And at first, Esther hesitates. She actually doesn't act at first. She sends a message back to Mordecai and says, I can't just approach the king. You see, there's a rule. If I just go up to the king before he extends his golden scepter to me to invite me to talk to him, then I could be put to death for that. So I can't just go to the king. It's been 30 days since he's asked for my company. So Mordecai then comes back with this wonderful challenge. And I think that there's elements of this challenge that are applicable to all of us. And he says, do you really think that you're going to be safe in a palace just because you're in a palace? You see, if you don't act, deliverance will come from somewhere else. God will still save his people. But you and your family will miss out on the reward that God has for you. You'll be ruined. And weren't you put in your royal position for just such a time as this? It's a very challenging thing to say, but clearly they have this very close, trusting relationship, and Esther listens. And so she asks Mordecai to ask the Jewish people to pray and fast for 3 days. And on the third day, she goes to the king. She hovers around on the inside courts, risking her life, because if he doesn't then invite her, she'll be put to death. He extends the golden scepter. She's invited in. And the king says, Esther, my queen, ask anything you want. I'll give you even up to half the kingdom, and you can have it. And so she says, just come to a banquet, because she knows how to get on Xerxes' good side. So she says, just come to a banquet and bring that noble Haman. Bring Haman. And so that's what he does. Haman is overjoyed at this. He gets to go, and he's the only noble invited to the special royal banquet between Queen Esther and King Xerxes. So he's delighted. And anyway, so they go to this banquet. It's a very nice banquet. And at the end of the banquet, Xerxes says again to Esther, what is it that I can do for you? Even up to half my kingdom, I'll give it to you. And Esther says, come to another banquet tomorrow, and then I will tell you. Haman goes home. He's overjoyed. He's skipping down the streets. He thinks he's the guy. He's the top noble. All the others are supposed to be bowing to him. And now even Queen Esther has him over for dinner. And then he goes past Mordecai, who doesn't bow. And he gets home. And by the time he's home, he's in a fit of rage again. Because how can he possibly enjoy all of this privilege and wonderful stuff if that Mordecai won't bow to me? And so his family advise him, say, you know what? Have a massive spike put up in your land. And then tomorrow, because you're the most powerful noble, you can ask the king and he'll grant it. You can execute Mordecai on the massive spike. Pretty gruesome, right? Anyway, so then that's what he does. The spike gets erected in on his land. Meanwhile, overnight, the king can't sleep. So what do you do when you can't sleep? You read a history book. So the king gets out all the annals of his people and he starts reading through the history books. And he reads upon this kind of weird occasion when there was actually a plot to assassinate him. And Mordecai the Jew foiled the plot. And then he's reading for the bit where Mordecai gets celebrated and honoured, and it doesn't come. And he's wondering, why didn't this guy get rewarded or anything as a result of this? And so he hears that there's someone hanging around in his outer courts, and so he invites that person. It happens to be Haman. Hi, Haman. Right. So what should I do, Haman, for the man who the king needs to honour greatly? Haman thinks his ship's come in. First, he's going to these special royal banquets. He's already the most famous noble. And now he's going to get specially honoured by the king. So he dreams up, like, his favourite possible treat. And he says, right, okay, king, get the best cloak, put that on this person. And then get your best horse, put him on that. And then lead him around the city and declare to everyone, this is what happens for the man the king wants to honour. And the king says, that's a great idea. Go and do that immediately for Mordecai. Haman is distraught. He has to lead Mordecai, who is hoping to execute that day, instead around the city saying, how great is this guy? Anyway, he goes home after this, his face ashen, and he explains the situation to his family. And his family are actually quite incisive. And they say, you know what? It sounds like Mordecai is becoming more favored than you. I reckon your lot's up, mate. You're in trouble here because you've set yourself against Mordecai, and now it seems like the power balance has shifted. And so they're still worrying about this, wondering what to do, when Esther's servants arrive to take him to the second banquet. So he goes to the second banquet, and there at the second banquet, King Xerxes says to Esther, Esther, my queen, even up to half my kingdom, will you tell me now? What is it that you want me to do? And so Esther says, save me and my people. We have been sold to be killed, annihilated, and destroyed. And the king, I don't know how, he seems to have forgotten the fact that he signed the edict only a few months ago. But anyway, the king stands up in a rage and says, who dares create this edict? Who's done this to my queen and her people? And she says, well, it's Haman. He's sitting next to you. You remember the edict? Anyway, so it's Haman. The king stands up, storms out in a rage. Haman realizes he's in serious trouble here. And so he starts pouring all over Esther. Esther sits down on a couch to wait for the king to calm down and come back. And Haman, in the meanwhile, falls onto her, pawing at her, saying, save me, Queen Esther. That's the exact moment, bad timing, that King Xerxes walks back into the room. And he says, will she even molest my queen in my palace? And so someone puts a sackcloth over Haman's head as a sign that he's condemned. And one of the servants rather helpfully pipes up, by the way, Haman has got this massive spike on his land. He was planning to execute Mordecai on it, you know, just saying. And so guess what? Haman is eventually executed on the great spike that he had set up for Mordecai. With the laws of the Medes and Persians, they can't just repeal the edict that they sent out. So instead what they do is they send out a new edict that says the Jews are now allowed to defend themselves. So weirdly enough, the Jews end up squashing the anti-Semitic rebellion at the same time as defending their own land and being able to maintain their own people. Esther ends up inheriting all of Haman's wealth and property, and Mordecai becomes second in command of the kingdom of Persia and goes on, we are told, to rule very successfully and famously with the king. So I was wondering where you thought you might fit in to Esther's story. Which part of that did you think that you related to the most? I wonder if there are people here who perhaps feel like they most relate to Hannah before she became Esther, to the Jewish orphan girl who perhaps didn't have many people saying, you know what, you're going to go on to do great things. Perhaps you don't feel like you've got much to offer yourself in the way of groundbreaking, life-changing stuff. So I wonder if you identify with that moment in Esther's life. And I wanted to just draw out a couple of points from what actually Esther needs to do and what happens in the passage. You see, Esther doesn't go on some radical course. She doesn't change her personality. She does it. She is able to remain just Esther. All she actually does is she agrees to attend a beauty pageant because her mate Mordecai told her to. That's what God requires of you. Not that you massively change your personality, but that you change your self-perception of your value. The other thing that Esther needs is she needed Mordecai. And I think it's really important, if you identify with Esther at that moment, that you have people around you like Mordecai. That maybe you're in a life group. Maybe you're not and you should be. Because actually, if you're in a life group and you get really honest with people and you get really vulnerable with people and they know you and your circumstance, then they can say things. They can give challenges like Mordecai was able to do for Esther and create opportunities. And I wonder, is there someone in your life like that? See, I'm really lucky. I get to attend a fantastic life group. And so, for example, if Liz says something to me in my life, I listen because she's like Mordecai. We have that relationship. And I think it's really important that everybody has someone like that or has people like that around them. I wonder if maybe you identify, well, actually, I thought we might step back a little bit because it might be the case that you're sort of wondering, well, why is it that I can assume that God is as interested in your life as he was interested in Esther's life? See, back in the Old Testament times, I might not have been able to say that because most people's experience of faith and religion was not that they were anointed for anything in particular, but they had this corporate idea of worship. They believed a set of beliefs and they expressed those beliefs in a cultural context in worship. And actually, that's what critics often say about religion, isn't it? It's just a set of beliefs that you ascribe to within a given cultural context. And they then ask the question or give the challenge, well, if your set of beliefs and culture tell you this, and someone else's set of beliefs and culture tell them that, then what is there to tell the difference between you? If you try and persuade them to be like you, isn't that just a form of cultural imperialism? It's a reasonable question in many respects. But Christianity is totally different from that. Christianity is not just a set of beliefs in a cultural context. Being a Christian is about having a living, dynamic relationship with God. All of us have the potential to be like Esther. All of us have an anointing. The moment that you accept Jesus' sacrifice for you, you get instant connection with God. Instant closeness. He gives his very spirit himself to live in you to transform you and transform the world around you. Suddenly you are empowered to have life-changing encounters every day of your life all around you. There are periods of my Christian life that have been very much like that, when I've not known where God is moving next. And it's electrifying. And I wonder, if you've never made that connection, if you've never had that experience of that personal relationship with God, then don't let this day go past without talking to someone who you know has. Talk to me, talk to Eric, talk to any of the leadership or people that you know well. Because actually, that, if you've never experienced that, you might well be missing out. And there are people who go to churches who are sleepwalking their way into an eternity without God because they haven't made that connection. They don't understand that this isn't just a set of beliefs, turning up on a Sunday and then living your week as though nothing's changed. This should be a life-changing account. That's why they call it being born again. I wonder if maybe you've known life like that, if you've known a relationship with God with that kind of closeness in the past, but perhaps it was in the past and you don't so much experience that now anymore. I wonder if there are people who have that experience. I think that's a very common experience. And I think the things that I wanted to say to you again were, what you need is really the same things that Esther needed at the beginning of her journey. But perhaps you identify a bit more with Esther in her palace hesitating because she's fearful. Maybe you identify a bit more with comfortable Esther. You might not think of yourselves as a comfortable Christian. But actually, I wonder how many of us, if we're honest and we think back over the last week or 2 weeks, how many of us know for sure that we deliberately missed an opportunity to share our faith with someone? Or how many of us know that we missed out another opportunity to right a wrong or correct a lie or to challenge an injustice? How many of us know that we're not taking opportunities that God presents us with? And you see, if we shrink back from that, and if we shrink back from that ongoing, challenging, dynamic relationship with Jesus, then actually, in a way, we're just regressing to that two-dimensional Old Testament view of faith, aren't we? We're no longer living every day with Jesus. We're just sort of trying to hope he doesn't mind if we just have the beliefs and do the cultural thing and nothing else. And that's a significant regression. And I think Jesus would want to challenge us about that. You know, in both of these cases, Esther at the beginning of her life, where perhaps she would have said that she wasn't going to set the world alight, and Esther in the middle, where perhaps she was hesitating because perhaps she was too easily satisfied by what she had, because she was worried about losing the little that she had, even though it might meant that she could have saved her whole people. You know, both of those situations, I think Esther is undervaluing herself. She's not understanding the true impact that can happen when you and I just walk hand in hand, step by step with God and let him lead us. You know, Jesus is a bit like the greatest ever car restorer who goes to a scrap heap. And when he goes into the scrap heap, he sees a 76 Shelby Mustang just sitting there on the scrap. And he goes to the owner of the scrap heap and he says, you know, that car, can I buy that? And the owner says, yeah, sure, 50 quid. But Jesus, obviously, is an honest car restorer. And so he says, no, that's a 76 Shelby Mustang. I'm going to give you $5,000 for that. And actually, in some respects, if we are a bit too hesitant to step out in faith because we're too easily satisfied by what our life looks like right now, or maybe if we're a bit too hesitant because we just think that we're not capable, we just think we're not enough, then we're being like the owner of the scrap heap. We're not understanding the purchase price that Jesus has put on us. And as we approach communion, as we drink the wine that represents blood shed for us, and we eat the bread that represents the body broken for us, let's just reflect on the purchase price that Jesus has given us. You see, you might not feel that you have that much to offer. You might identify with that early Esther. But, you know, this is what Jesus says you're worth. It doesn't matter what self-esteem issues you have, or it doesn't matter what background or what other psychological baggage you might be carrying with you, or what start you haven't had, or what education you haven't had, what station in life you don't have. This is what Jesus says your value is. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. You might identify with hesitant Esther. And just like that, we might be too satisfied making mud pies in a slum, when actually the Lord has called us to make beautiful sandcastles on a pristine beach. This is what he's bought you for. This is what you mean to him. This is how important it is that you have daily, ongoing closeness with God. So as we have our communion, let's reflect on that. Let's invite Jesus back into our lives. Let's recommit ourselves to live every day with him. And if you haven't already, and if you're not already, talk to someone about joining a life group. Get involved in a life group. Make sure there are people in your life like Mordecai for you. Because we all need that to push us along and to challenge us at various points.